What happens when you don't pay your bills for 2.5 years? If you're Illinois, it means owing more than $1 billion just in late fees. Comptroller Susana Mendoza says that money is going down the drain.
It's not going to go to fix a single road or bridge or educate a single child. It's very, very unconscionable, frankly, that we would have allowed our state's finances to come to this type of disarray.
Plus, nearly 20 years ago, State Senator Kimberly Lightford had a baby while in office, and she says back then, some colleagues were a little sexist about it.
I wasn't equal, but they weren't mean to me or overly aggressive in the sense that they didn't welcome my child. Other things that they did was inappropriate at times.
That audio from NPR Illinois, we talk about being a new parent in public office. That's all coming up this hour in the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Maybe you're one of those people who never pays a bill late or pays in full. For the rest of us, think about when you rack up a few months' worth of credit card bills and have to pay those late fees. Now multiply that by $16 billion. That's how big Illinois' bill backlog is, according to the most recent report by Comptroller Susana Mendoza, who's on the line with us now. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
So I know you've talked about this in the past, but I'm hoping you can explain to everyone, maybe people who are hearing this for the first time, how did we accumulate this bill backlog?
We accumulated, unfortunately, up to a $16.7 billion backlog of unpaid bills. And the vast majority of that occurred over the last 2.5 years because of the budget impasse. We just recently put out a report that highlights not just the bill backlog, but also the late payment interest penalties that resulted as a result of not paying our bills on time. But this is something that Governor Rauner did not entirely create the entire mess of the 16.7, but when he took office, he inherited $5 billion worth of unpaid bills from the prior administration, which was a Democratic administration. He's not responsible for that, but he certainly has to take ownership of the more than $11 billion that it was incurred just over a two-year administration. We're now into his third year. But we did go 2 full years without a budget, and that's what happens when you're not paying your bills during that time.
Can you remind us exactly who the state of Illinois owes all of these different payments to?
It's anyone who does any kind of business with the state of Illinois that would be required to be paid by the state of Illinois. So you're talking about social service providers, healthcare providers, education, corrections, you name it. If it's happening in Illinois and it has any interaction with the state of Illinois and they would require a payment, a vendor who provides, let's say, the food at the correctional facilities, the people who fix your roads, who build bridges, who build schools, all of those folks who would at some point receive payment from the state were essentially made into unwilling lenders over the last 2.5 years. Of the Rauner administration because we were not paying them, yet they were, in essence, providing the services that they promised to provide through contracts.
And Comptroller, I just want to ask you about what's in this also. We've had past conversations on the 21st about, for example, salary that's owed to state workers. Is that included in this number?
Yes. So good point. We have the salaries are not included in the bill backlog because we went 2 full years without a budget and the courts had to intervene. And so thankfully we were able to keep government operational because we were able to, by court order, continue to pay the state employees. So the employee salaries are not part of the bill backlog. They were paid. But for example, if employees needed to have access to brain surgery, which is not an exaggeration, literally we had situations where people who had fully paid into their healthcare premiums and then got sick and required, it could be something so simple as a tooth to be removed to brain surgery, were then denied medical coverage or medical service because the state was so far behind on paying the state's health care bills. So the employees still got paid, but again, anybody who is a vendor to the state of Illinois, and certainly this impacted very vulnerable populations, for example, victims of domestic violence, children and adults with disabilities, the obvious vulnerable groups, but it also affected any kind of business, small business or large, who had contracts with the state that went ahead and delivered good service, but were basically stiffed for 2.5 years.
I know a large part of the work that you've done is to just be able to quantify what's actually owed. What are the steps in beginning to clear some of this?
So we've done a really great job over the last year. It's not been a whole year and a half that I've been in office, but I'm very proud of the work that we've done to put a focus on having to get our state's fiscal house in order. We were very, very vocal and had to take on the governor to almost essentially shame him into agreeing to do a bonding deal that allowed us to refinance almost $6.5 billion of that $16.7 bill backlog, and refinance it from a 12% late interest payment that we were paying to a 3.5%, and being able to manage our money being able to use smart fiscal policies to go ahead and pay down that debt by utilizing, for example, matching federal reimbursements for every dollar that we spent on certain state bills, allowed us to bring down that bill backlog from essentially that almost $17 billion to what today is just $7.2 billion. Now, it's still a lot of money that we owe, but we have certainly done a great job in cutting that bill backlog by more than half, and we're moving in the right direction.
And does this include the backlog? Does this also include what you've calculated in terms of late payment interest payments that need to be made?
So it includes a portion of those late payment interest penalties, but not all. But it does include the vast majority of them. We have about $883 million as of today that we know about in late payment interest penalties off of the $1.2 billion that were incurred under Governor Runner. We have over, like in December and so far this year, have made some payments in timely pay, which is a version of the late payment interest penalties. So we've paid down and now are at about $883 million, and about $783 million of that is included in the bill backlog. There's essentially another $100 million and growing that is not included in the backlog.
And when I say late interest penalties, I mean, for example, to your point of health insurance, not paying, for example, different things that are owed. The state then has to pay, I believe it's a 10% when it comes to medical bills for its employees, the interest rate that it has to pay back.
Yeah, so our bills collect interest that varies between 9 and 12%. The majority of the healthcare bills are at the 9%. But it is still a ridiculous amount of money that is essentially not going to anything of value for taxpayers. It's the equivalent of burning it in a big pile of horrible fire. And it's not going to go to fix a single road or bridge or educate a single child or help any adult or child with disabilities. It brings no value. And it's very, very unconscionable, frankly, that we would have allowed our state's finances to come to this type of disarray.
I think some people might be listening and think about bill backlog or think about debt and think, well, the U.S. government has a lot of debt. Why does it matter if Illinois has this?
Well, number one, that's not a good excuse just because other people do it, that we should follow that, too. We should run a fiscally responsible operation here. But having said that, there's a key difference in that the federal government can print money. The state of Illinois cannot. So we really do have to do a better job of living within our means, of prioritizing services that would have a good return on investment for taxpayers, things like substance abuse treatment. For example, for every dollar that we put towards treating a person who is afflicted with an addiction, for example, opioid addictions, which are causing so many problems in Illinois, for every $1 we spend there on the front end, we save $14 in the correctional system or in emergency room care. So how we utilize the limited dollars that we have coming in is important. Are we going to put them towards efforts that have a greater return on investment? For example, higher education on average generates $8 for each dollar we spend on it. We should be looking at investing more wisely when it comes to how we spend those taxpayer dollars. And that's kind of the story that we want to talk about as controller, is we're not just paying the bills, we're also analyzing how well or how poorly the state is doing in spending people's money.
And how would you say we're doing right now?
I think we've done a poor job. And certainly over the last 2.5 years, this governor has taken it upon himself to almost dismantle the higher education system in Illinois. We've seen a reduction of over 60% in funding to higher education under the Rauner administration. And again, you know, these are the numbers. This is not my own opinion, but if you look at the numbers and you see a over 60% reduction in our higher ed investment, when we know that it could, in fact, give us a significant return on investment, that's just not smart business. It's not morally sound, and it certainly is not fiscally sound. So I think if I had to grade the governor, I think you probably know the grade I'd give him, and it's not a good one. I would say he's a failed governor, and unfortunately, if it were just him, that wouldn't be a problem. But, you know, his actions impact millions of people in Illinois and set the stage for many years of recovery.
I wonder what grade would you give the same grade to Democratic lawmakers as well in the General Assembly?
Well, I think that there's plenty of blame to share for both Democrats and Republicans. And we've had good Democratic governors and we've had pretty horrendous ones, right? So I led the impeachment efforts on a terrible governor who was a Democrat. But having said that, no governor has done the damage to the state's finances. And this is not my opinion. Again, this is backed up by concrete numbers that paint this story very clearly. No one has done the damage to the state of Illinois' finances the way Governor Rauner has. And, like, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but, you know, Governor Rauner in just 2.5 years has done more damage to the state's finances than all of the Democratic and Republican administrations and legislatures over the previous 18 years combined. That is what backed up 100% by the numbers, just on late payment interest penalties alone. The past 18 years of governors, which were both Democrats and Republicans, by the way, racked up $1.04 billion in late payment interest penalties. That's billion with a B. And Governor Rauner in just 2 years versus those 18 years, just one governor in 2.5 years, racked up $100 million more than the prior 18 years worth of governors. So those are numbers that paint a very clear picture of a failed administration. But unfortunately, the failure is not just a personal one. It impacts the state at every single level, whether it's core responsibilities of making your debt service payments or pension payments or road improvements or education commitments, you name it, Illinois has suffered as a result. And we will be for more years to come until we're able to get on a stronger path to fiscal footing. And I'm working hard to get us there.
I'm speaking with Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about one thing. And in fact, you mentioned you were in the legislature before holding this office. And I wanted to just ask you about a topic we're going to be discussing coming up next. And it's about women in public office and being a new mom in office. And of course, we're talking about this because of Senator Duckworth just making history with Miley, her daughter that was born recently. You also had a baby while in public office. Do you think there's enough support for new parents who are also to elected officials?
Well, I think we need to do a better job of supporting working moms. I mean, you always hear these questions about how do you balance work and family life. You always get that question as a woman. It's interesting that no one ever asked that question of men, right, who are in the workforce. But I will say that when I had my son, and I had him when I was a city clerk in the city of Chicago, I received from the city of Chicago, certainly the mayor was the first person to implement a work leave for moms. We didn't have that prior to actually me giving birth. So I was the first elected official or city employee, you could say, the first city employee who was ever elected to office at some point who benefited from the maternal leave policy. And I think, like, we need to do more things like that, certainly across the state, in all the municipalities. Senator Duckworth, first of all, congratulations for being a super mom. This is such a fun topic to talk about, but there's still, you know, we need to do a better job of not just in government, but just across the board of providing comforting and supportive work environments for mothers who are new mothers, because it's not an easy thing. We do a lot, and I think working moms want to feel that they're supported and not really discriminated against because you decide to have a family, and that happens very much, right? It still happens today that if people know that you're interested in having a family and want to do that, that might impact, in their minds, your ability to do your job. you know, I've certainly proven that that didn't stop me from pulling off the greatest transition in the history of the city clerk's office. I did it while I got pregnant, I had my baby, and breastfed him for 9 months, and we still pulled off the greatest transition in the history of that city and that office. So these things are possible. Nothing's impossible for women. We can do it all. But it would be nice to feel that that level of strong support from others is there for us as we take on what seems to be nearly impossible, but certainly doable for any good mom.
And when it comes to working mothers in politics, what do you think needs to change in Illinois?
Well, I will say that in Illinois, for example, in our House, I don't know about the Senate, but I remember when I was a member of the House, we have a very family-oriented policy. I mean, members were able to bring their newborns and their children onto the floor at any time. And I remember there was a front page picture in the Chicago Tribune before I was ever even dating anyone of me doing work on the floor, but also holding a newborn baby in my hand who fell asleep in my arms. So, you know, we're juggling a baby and making sure that we were doing what we needed to do on the House floor. It was Mary Kay O'Brien, who is now a judge. She was a representative, and it was her baby. And we would take turns babysitting that baby on the House floor. And that's been the policy for many years. I would assume that the same would hold in the Senate. But I think we all need to do our part in Illinois. I have a very, very strong work environment policy, work family environment policy in my office, where we say, if schools are out, bring your kids. You know, we're not going to turn anyone away for trying to be a good parent, and we can do both. So we need to do more policies actually set in law, whether it's in the private sector or through government, that support that.
Comptroller Susana Mendoza, thanks for being with me. I appreciate you taking the time. Back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Earlier this month, Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth brought her newborn daughter Miley to the Senate floor. It was the first in the history of the U.S. Senate, and it took a vote to change Senate rules just to make it happen. We're talking about this issue now of new parents in politics. Senator Duckworth was unable to join us for an interview, but we did have a chance to speak with our other senator from Illinois. Senator Dick Durbin has been in Congress for a long time. He first started in Washington in 1982 when he was elected to the House. And with that in mind, when I spoke to him last week, I started by asking how Congress has changed over the years as a working environment for new parents.
There are a lot more women. There are 23 now. It's a record number in the United States Senate. It wasn't that long ago that there was only one, Barbara Mikulski, who had been elected in her own right, very few in history. I served, of course, with Carol Mosley Braun when I first came to the Senate chamber, but we're really seeing a dramatic increase in women, and with that, younger members and now new families.
And I know the vote to allow babies on the Senate floor was unanimous, but I wanted to ask you at some of the comments that some of your Senate colleagues made, and I'm thinking in particular of Senate Orrin Hatch, who asked, what if you pass this rule and there are 10 babies on the floor?
Well, it's a reflection on the fact that Orrin, my buddy, is a big, huge family. He's a Mormon by his faith choice, and Mormons are well known for having large families. His Christmas card, it looks like a high school reunion or something.
There are more than 10 babies, I imagine.
Oh, there are lots and lots of babies on there. But I think that Orrin is just got to understand that the Senate that he was elected to so many years ago is not the Senate of today. One of my colleagues, after I said a few words on the floor, stood up, and when I mentioned diaper bags, he said, they don't use diaper bags anymore. They have disposable diapers. And I went up to him afterwards and said, what do you think they carry those around in? I mean, you have to have a bag, but it reflects the fact that many of my colleagues are, I'm sure, loving grandfathers, maybe even great-grandfathers, but it's been a long time since they've had to rock a baby to sleep.
Or change a diaper, apparently.
Exactly.
Does the Senate feel like a boys' club to you, though, all seriousness aside?
It's really changing. It really is. You can tell it in the nature and culture of the place. And it's a hopeful sign because not only new faces are coming, but many women are coming, and they have a different look at things. You know, the women of the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, get together on a monthly basis and just kind of chat about their lives in the Senate. It's a positive thing. There are many more bipartisan efforts that emerge from that. So my hat's off to them. I really think they're adding something to the Senate and will have a bigger and bigger impact as time goes on.
Senator Durbin, I think oftentimes we think this conversation about families is one that's being led by women. And certainly we saw this in this case with this rule with Senator Duckworth and with Senator Klobuchar from Minnesota, who did much of the talking that day on the floor on behalf of Senator Duckworth. What role do you think male senators should be playing in this conversation?
Well, of course, we need to be supportive and understanding. And I might, you know, just make it clear, this rule does not just apply to moms, it's dads too. And in the first year after a baby is born, the Senate rules allow mother or father to bring the baby to the floor during the roll call vote. And you say to yourself, well, couldn't you just hand off the baby in the cloakroom or something? Well, of course you could. But I think what we're saying is that we don't view this as a hostile act or one inappropriate in the Senate. A roll call vote is one where there are no speeches being made, but members are coming and going on the floor. And if a mom or dad wants to, you know, bring a baby on the floor to vote, I don't see any objection at all to that. In fact, I think it's a good thing. Be reminded, bottom line, that whether it's mother or father, we're all in this together.
That's U.S. Senator Dick Durbin giving us the picture from Washington. Of course, here in Illinois, babies have been brought to the floor of the General Assembly for some time, but we wanted to spend some time talking about what it's like to be a new parent in politics here in Illinois. To do that, I'm joined now by State Senator Kimberly Lightford. She's a Democrat representing Illinois' 4th Senate District, which includes some of Chicago's western suburbs, including South Austin and Forest Park. Also on the line with us is Republican State Representative Sarah Wojcicki Jimenez from Illinois' 99th House District, which includes parts of Springfield and areas to the west of the city. Senator, Representative, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Representative Jimenez, Wojcicki Jimenez, I wonder if I could start with you. Before we get to your own experience with being a parent in public office, I first wanted to get your reaction to what you heard from Senator Durbin. Of course, he was talking about Washington, not Springfield. But do you think that there's the still mostly older white men in politics are coming around the idea of women having babies and having babies in office? What's it like in Springfield?
You know, in the House floor, since I've been a state rep, and even when I was on staff, I served as a staffer here at the Capitol, it seemed to me that babies and little ones have been welcome on the House floor. And so, quite frankly, when I saw the news about Senator Duckworth and that they were having to take a vote, that was a little surprising to me because that wasn't, you know, my experience here at the Capitol and in Springfield. And in fact, my seatmate just last week had his daughter here in Springfield. He's from the suburbs, and the clerk of the House, his name is Tim Mapes, made sure that he felt comfortable that, you know, the little one could run around and don't be nervous about that because, you know, just trying to make that situation comfortable. You know, it's not like everyone brings their kids every day to the House floor, but on occasion, members do bring their kids or babies, and it's a welcome thing, and especially for the members who have to travel some distance, that's a lot of time away from your family, and it's something that's quite frankly encouraged.
And it sounds like, Representative, it sounds like this is something Springfield sounds like it's way ahead of Washington. Do you think that's accurate?
I mean, I guess so, because I was surprised. I didn't know that there was a rule against it or whatever. They had to be clearer with a vote in Washington that had to happen, because I don't think that it's even part of our rules or something here. I mean, I'll have to review them, but, you know, it's just one of those things that if you're, you know, from the day you come in, you know, they have to get a little badge with their little picture on it, and they wear that when they come, you know, if you bring your kids. But that's the only thing you have to do. There isn't a big ordeal about it.
Senator Lightford, and I imagine it sounds like we just heard Representative Wojcicki Jimenez talking about the House. I imagine in the state Senate, it sounds like babies have also been welcome for some time. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I had my son in 2001, and when he was 8 months old is when he experienced his first Springfield session in early 2002. And I'm the only woman to have bared a child. I believe most of the women have been out of childbearing ages. So I bear that distinction of being the first and only. But I know that we have younger women coming into the Illinois Senate who do not have children and perhaps will have children in the future. So I know that the legislature would be open to them. Generally, the House has more younger elected officials. And so it's something that has been accepted for a very long time. But in the Senate, we've had no other babies. So I've got the one and only Senate baby.
What was that like, Senator? Was it something that your colleagues, I would imagine, even particularly your male colleagues, did they remark upon that?
They teased me. They teased me a bit. They called me fun names like Roly-Poly and things like that. But they were very caring. They would check on me on a regular basis. Are you okay? Do you need anything? I was experiencing some challenges in my pregnancy when I was about 7 months old, and I would have to keep my legs elevated. And so they want to know if I needed a step stool or if I needed a blanket. I was always cold on the floor. And lucky for me, Senator Obama at that time, his wife Michelle was pregnant. Senator Tom Walsh's wife was expecting, and Senator Dan Cronin, and Senator Kirk Dillard at that time. So there were other men in the chamber who wives were expecting, and so they would treat me, I guess, just as polite as they would treat their wife. And so I had nothing but support during my pregnancy and once I brought my son there.
And Representative, you had twins, correct, when you were in office? Representative, would you? Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. So I had, when I came into office as a state representative, my twin boys had just turned 3, but I did have them when I was on staff. So I was on legislative staff in the House. I was the press secretary for the House Republican leader. And so I had them when I was on staff, and then they were 3 years old when I became a state rep.
And when you had them when you were on staff, do you think that the rules and the environment, is it a little bit different when you're a staffer versus an elected official?
So I had them in October, and which was actually good timing for the legislative session, if you know Springfield, because the bulk of our session is between January and May. So it timed out as a staff person pretty well. I had taken 3 months off after they were born to be with them at home. And when I came back, you know, I brought them in one time just to meet a few of the members, but I didn't bring them in, you know, to session or have them there during the day once I came back to work, of course. But yeah, it was, everybody was very welcoming. You know, when you're having twins, it's hard to hide it. It's very clear when you're pregnant with twins, and then it's a challenging time for the first year or so, having twins at home and working full time, especially on a legislative staff where the hours are not exactly 9 to 5. But I found that everybody was supportive of me in my time. And you know, one of the things I think you do as a young woman who's having children and you're on legislative staff or in some of these political jobs. It generally still is a boys' club, a man's club, and you just have to be very clear with people in terms of when you have to go home, and you can't do some of those later night meetings and that sort of thing because you've got to get home to the babies. But people were very understanding during that time. It was just sometimes you had to remind them.
And I want to ask both of you about this. Representative, let's start with you, and then Senator, if you can chime in after. Earlier in the program, we did hear Comptroller Susana Mendoza say that she feels like for women, there's still this perception that if you have children, you won't be as dedicated to your colleagues as your to your career as your male colleagues. Do you think that attitude persists? Is that something that you had to deal with, Representative?
Oh, sure. I think, you know, all along the way, whether it be on the campaign trail, just talking to constituents, or sometimes just a feeling you get that you are asked the question, maybe more often than your male counterparts, how are you going to do this? How are you going to be a state rep and be a mom? You have three-year-old twins. How are you going to make this possible and get everything you need to get done? And I think, look, it's not a graceful process, that's for sure. But I've been a person who's obviously been very committed to my career, now to my constituents as a state representative. And I was always shocked when somebody would ask me that question, because I thought, well, my goodness, you're a dad or whoever you are, or and sometimes it would come from women, too. It just wouldn't always come from men. And I would look at them and I'd think, well, how do you do it? You know, we're all trying to do this work and home life and balance together, and sometimes it's not very graceful, but you figure out a way to balance the different things. But to be honest, it would shock me when someone would ask me that, because I thought, I mean, people are working and having families all the time. It's sort of a weird question to ask, but I got better and better about answering it, that's for sure.
Senator Lightford?
I would just add that the balance was most important, and people would ask that question, and I kind of would go straight to it and just say, I'm searching for a balance. I'm still trying to find out how to navigate what's necessary to make sure that I don't miss a beat with my child, but also be the best legislator and wife that I could possibly be as well. And so as women, we kind of, you know, it's not enough time in the day to get it all done. So we begin to neglect ourselves slightly. And so I just would share all the time that it's really what I want to do. I want to be a mom, and I would encourage young women to not fear that they couldn't have a successful career because they would be become a mother, or to prevent them from having children because they would be afraid that they couldn't do it all. And so I had a playpen and a high chair in my office for my son. He was there from 8 months old until he turned the age of three. And that's when I put him in school, and he stayed back home with his grandparents. But those young age where it was very critical, I didn't want to miss anything. I was attached to my child, and I just wanted to make sure that I provided the best opportunities possible. When he began to be a little noisy, where I may have felt he was disrupting a caucus meeting or a regular meeting, I put him in daycare in Springfield. And so I would get up and get myself and get my son dressed, drop him off at daycare, and then I would go to the Capitol, and then I would pick him up in due time, but I was unable to attend those receptions and those evening events. So there was this, I guess, kind of sort of a stigma that young women and women with children aren't as effective as men are. But I believe that we've proved that to be different, that we are as effective, if not even more so effective, because we know how to strike that work balance and with life and family and children and spouses. I think we just do more.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Senator Kimberly Lightford and Representative Sarah Wojcicki Jimenez as we're talking about new parents in office here on the 21st. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about one particular issue regarding women in politics, and it's because U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth made history earlier this month when she became the first sitting U.S. senator to give birth while in office. A few weeks after that, she worked with her colleagues to pass a rule that now allows any new parent to bring their baby onto the Senate floor to vote. As it turns out, the U.S. Senate is one of the last holdouts in this regard, as we've been hearing this hour. Republican Rodney Davis represents Illinois' 13th congressional district in Washington. I spoke to him last week and asked him what he thought about that rule change.
Oh, it's great. I'm glad Tammy brought the issue up. Frankly, I had no idea that that rule even existed, because there are plenty of babies that have been on the House floor since I've been elected 5.5 years ago. I was glad Tammy led the charge. I'm proud of her and proud of the unanimous support that she got from her colleagues, both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate, so that she could have her baby on the floor to do the job that her constituents and my constituents sent her there to do.
Would you say that it's probably an easier working environment for women in the House than in the Senate?
Oh, I'm not in the Senate a lot, so I can't really talk about their working environment. But what I can tell you is, obviously, this wasn't a problem in the House, because Senator Duckworth and many of my other colleagues who have had children while serving in the House of Representatives, they would have brought it up if they wouldn't have been able to bring their babies on the floor. But we've been very open in the House, and it's great that we have. Again, I never knew it was a problem in the Senate until Senator Duckworth brought it to America's attention.
That's 13th District Congressman Rodney Davis. On Friday, Senator Duckworth's Friendly Airports for Mothers Act passed out of the U.S. House of Representatives Committee as part of the FAA's Reauthorization Act of 2018. It creates spaces at all medium or large airports to have an accessible, clean, and convenient lactation rooms for nursing moms. It now goes before the full Senate. We're talking about this issue of new parents in office with State Senator Kimberly Lightford of Illinois' 4th Senate District, along with State Representative Sarah Wojcicki Jimenez from Illinois' 99th House District. Representative, can I ask you, when we think about that legislation that Senator Duckworth was working on as an example of laws she's proposing to help new moms, do you feel like our legislation as it stands both in Illinois is sufficient to help all working parents and all new moms?
So we are looking at a number of measures in Illinois also as it pertains to private places for women to be able to, for them to be able to breastfeed. And so, you know, this is a measure that I think is coming up before us at all levels. You know, I think even 5 years ago, my boys are five, when I was a breastfeeding mom, you know, at that time you're just sort of trying to figure out where you can go and where it's private. You aren't thinking necessarily, oh, I wish there was a different space or whatever. When you're in the moment, you're trying to find a private space, or you decide you don't think there is one, so you just don't go, or you maybe stay home a little more often or plan your schedule around the feedings. Now, with me with twins, I think you can imagine that breastfeeding was a little more involved than with one baby.
I cannot imagine, so, but I'm sure that was a lot. Yeah.
So for me, you know, it's a little slightly different because, you know, I'm a person who's pretty modest anyway, and I would barely, you know, I had to find a very private place even in my own home with guests over because it was quite an ordeal. But I think these are different policies that legislators in the state are looking at. Whether you have a company or in local government, it seems like people are trying to be a little more sensitive to the idea that breastfeeding in a bathroom stall is not exactly, number one, the most sanitary, but, something where, you know, a mom would probably make a choice at that point to just wait till she gets home, or maybe just not go if that's the option.
Senator, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you what advice you have for all the women who are running for office right now, maybe either who are, or not just women, people who are running for office who are brand new parents or maybe have young kids.
I would encourage them to seek office because they bring a very new element and a diverse element to the legislature where perhaps it's more understanding of what families need and what communities need. So their perspective could be hugely effective. If I could just add that just a few years ago, I passed legislation to add the Nursing Mothers Act in O'Hara Airport and Midway Airport.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, thanks for that. Well, thank you for that. Yeah. We'll have to follow up with that, but I want to thank both Representative and Senator for being with me. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. With all the many extracurriculars available, college can be a time to try anything and everything, from improv to ultimate frisbee. And if you're at the University of Illinois, now you can add beekeeping to that list. Students have just formed at the University of Illinois its first beekeeping club. And with spring finally here, its members just unloaded their first package of bees to the Department of Crop Sciences Sustainable Student Farm. With me now in studio is the club president and University of Illinois freshman Danny Ferris. Adam Dolezal is on the line as well. He's a professor in the Department of Entomology. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Danny, let me start with you. Why bees?
My uncle keeps bees as a hobby, and every time I went down to visit, I just found it really interesting. And I thought, coming to college, it might be just the time to start something new. And I thought I'd join the beekeeping club, but there wasn't one, so I just got it started up.
Yeah, so you became your president. You're not studying. You're studying economics, right?
Yes, that's in economics.
This really is a hobby for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And your uncle, where does he live?
St. Charles.
Okay, so out of the city.
Yeah.
And I imagine that's a little bit different from where you grew up, just outside Chicago.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more land, a lot more cornfields.
And so, Danny, what's involved with being a beekeeper?
It's actually a pretty low commitment kind of thing. Like, estimates about 50 hours a year for one hive of, like, time dedicated to it. So you just have to put the bees in the box, they do their thing, and you check up on them every once in a while to make sure there's no, like, parasites killing them or make sure that the queen's, like, laying eggs fine.
Adam, the students, I imagine, did they reach out to you to help consult on this project?
Yeah, I was asked to be the faculty sponsor for the club, and I was really excited to do so. I had taught a beekeeping course at another university I was at, and so I was very happy to get involved with students who are getting started with beekeeping. I've had about 11 or 12 years experience keeping bees, mostly in a research capacity, and so I was happy to give them any experience I could with how to take care of and get hives started.
What are you hoping students can learn from this?
So I always argue that bees are this great example and this great window on how to learn lots of different things about biology. We know so much about bee ecology and bee physiology and bee evolution, and that they're important to agriculture. And so I think they're a great way as a hobby for a lot of people who may not be biology majors or crop science majors to get a window into all those aspects of the living world. And so that's one of the things I was so excited about when I met the club, is how many of them were not biology students or studying some biological sciences, because I think that they can get a lot out of beekeeping as a way to learn about the natural world and to learn about agricultural systems, even though their main field of study might not necessarily involve that.
And Danny, are you hoping that you're going to learn some things like that, or for you, you just want to kind of hang out with the bees a little bit?
I like learning, so yeah, I'm looking forward to expanding my knowledge.
So you said the bees just came in.
Yeah.
I imagine that's a seasonal thing, right? Because it doesn't make sense to have bees in the winter. It's too cold here.
Yeah, right about now is when everyone in this area will install their bees.
And where do you have the bees set up here on the University of Illinois campus?
They're at the Sustainable Student Farm, so the far south end, basically.
And how many bees do you start with?
We have two hives, so that means we ordered two packages. And each package is about 3 pounds of bees and one queen bee.
And how many students do you have involved?
At the meetings, about like 10 to 15 people show up. And then the mailing list has like a lot more people, but they're in it for like just reading what the club's about. So,
oh, okay. I thought they wanted maybe the, are you guys going to be collecting honey?
Yeah, absolutely.
So are there, I wonder if there are people who are involved because they want to get that part of it mm-hmm. also. And what are you guys going to be doing, the 15 of you? Just making sure that everything's okay?
Yeah, we're just going to check on the bees every once in a while. And we're also, like, the club is planning on doing a lot more events next year. We were using this year as, like, kind of a getting started. And so we've kind of started on more like community outreach stuff. So at Common Ground Co-op, we taught a baking with honey class. And next year we're planning on doing like making lip balm, other kinds of
stuff with the beeswax.
Yeah.
Adam, I wanted to ask you about that because we've certainly been hearing for a while about the decline in the bee population. Obviously, bees play a key pollinator role in the ecosystem. Where are we at today in terms of, as Danny is talking about this particular hive, what does that look like around central Illinois, around the whole state of Illinois in terms of our bee population?
Sure. So, you know, there's been a lot of concern, especially in the last decade, about the declines of bees and particularly honeybees. So one of the issues that we started to see more and more isn't necessarily that the number of hives is going to run out. We're not going to necessarily run out of honeybees. They're not going to go extinct. But in general, the costs of keeping bees have gone up pretty substantially in the past 10 or 15 years. Package prices have increased. The cost of keeping bees healthy and keeping bees well fed has increased. And so for hobby beekeepers, you'll see this. You'll see this cost increase and difficulty increase. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, there were a lot of people who could just have bees in their hive and do basically no management and keep them healthy and still get a honey crop. But today, to really keep bees in a responsible way does require a bit more work and a little bit more monitoring. You know, like Danny mentioned, there are some issues with parasites, specifically varroa mites, which are this parasitic mite that's really detrimental to the health of honeybees. It spreads viruses, kind of like mosquitoes do to people, and it's really can be really dangerous to hives. And so keeping those in check is really important, and doing so can be more difficult and more expensive. Mm-hmm. As more and more land has gone into corn and soybean production, we've seen the loss of a lot of areas that used to produce really great honey crops. They've now produced a lot less honey than they used to. And so there have become more and more difficulties that all kind of interact with each other. But that being said, you know, Illinois, especially southern and central Illinois, because it's a little bit warmer, still have a lot of great places to keep bees. There's still people who do it as their main occupation and their main living. It just has gone through transitions like a lot of different types of agriculture and industry have in the last 20 or 30 years.
So, Adam, what advice do you have for folks who maybe aren't going to be beekeepers but are concerned about the colony collapses and all of these other problems that you're talking about? What role do you want, what do you want people to know about that?
Sure. So one of the things that I always like to point out about honeybees is that, you know, honeybees are this agricultural animal that we keep and people love and we use a lot. But one of the things we also need to think about is the native bee populations that we have here in the Midwest. There are lots of native bee species that don't have beekeepers taking care of them. And one of the great things about conserving and helping with honeybees is a lot of those things will also benefit native bee communities. And so, you know, for the normal person, depending on what you do and what kind of world you live in, encouraging activities that are going to improve flowers, flower quantity, flower diversity. Those are the food sources for all these bees. That's always going to improve their health. Reducing the unnecessary use of pesticides like insecticides. We know that bees are insects, and so insecticides are going to be harmful to them. And that's not to say that there's no place for insecticide use, but recommendations of using integrative pest management, not spraying your yard with insecticides when you don't really need it. Those are going to help beneficial insects as well. And then for people who do keep bees, of course, they're the ones who are the only ones who can really deal with some of the issues with pathogens and diseases that are the other bane of beekeepers' existence.
Danny, what do you say to people who are scared of bees?
I'd say that really, if you don't mess with them, they won't mess with you. So when we put the bees in the hives, what we have is just a box of bees with a hole in it, and you shake it with all your might to get the bees out and into the box, and they don't get mad. They're not going to sting us. We did it without gloves because it wasn't really a problem. So there's really no reason to be scared of bees.
That's Danny Ferris. He's president of the first Beekeepers Club at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Adam Dolezal as well. He's an assistant professor, faculty advisor to the club in the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. Adam, Danny, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.